You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of essays by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Stages of Higher Knowledge, Imagination, Inspiration, Intuition. This is essay number 2, entitled Imagination. It is not possible to make real progress in penetrating higher realities without going through the stage of imaginative knowledge. This in no way implies that during esoteric training we are compelled to remain for a period at the imaginative stage, as though it were a class to be attended at school. In certain instances this may be necessary, but it is certainly not a general rule. It depends entirely upon what we as esoteric students have experienced before taking up esoteric training. It will be shown in this discussion that the spiritual environment of the esoteric student is important in this regard, and that depending on our orientation to this spiritual environment, diverse methods have been instituted for walking the path of knowledge. It can be of the utmost importance to know what follows if one is preparing to undergo esoteric training. Not merely as an interesting theory does this come into consideration, but as something by which manifold practical points of view can be gained if one is to succeed on the path to higher knowledge. It is often said by those striving toward a higher development, "I wish to become perfect spiritually. I wish to develop the higher self," in quotes, within me. But I have no desire for the manifestations of the astral world. This is understandable when one takes into consideration the descriptions of the astral world found in books dealing with such things. There, to be sure, appearances and beings are mentioned that bring all sorts of dangers to people. It will be said that under the influence of such beings, we may easily suffer harm to our moral disposition and mental health. It will be brought home to the reader that in these regions the wall dividing the good from the evil path is as a spider's web in thickness, and that the plunge into immeasurable abysses, the fall into utter depravity, lies all too near. It is, of course, impossible simply to contradict such assertions. Yet in many cases this view of walking the esoteric path is in no way correct. The only reasonable point of view is that no one should be deterred from traveling the way of higher knowledge because of dangers, but that in every case strict care must be taken to weather the dangers. It may happen that one who asks an esoteric teacher's guidance will be counseled to postpone actual training for a time and first undergo certain experiences of ordinary life or learn things that can be learned in the physical world. It will then be the task of the esoteric teacher to give the seeker the right instructions for accumulating such experiences and learning such things. In most cases, the esoteric teacher will be found to proceed in this way. If then you are sufficiently attentive to what happens to you after you have come into contact with the esoteric teacher, you will be able to observe many things. You will find that henceforth things happen to you as if, in quotes, by accident, and that you can observe things to which you would never have been exposed without a link with that esoteric teacher. If students do not notice this and become impatient, it is because they have not been attentive to what has happened to them. It should not be believed that the influence of the teacher upon the student will show itself in distinctly visible tricks of magic. Such influence is really an intimate matter, and those who would explore its nature and essence without having reached a certain stage of esoteric training will surely err. Students injure themselves in every case in which they become impatient toward the prescribed waiting time. Their advance will be nonetheless rapid on this account. On the contrary, one's progress would be slowed down by beginning too soon the training for which one often impatiently awaits. If students allow the waiting time, or the other advice and hints from the esoteric teacher, to influence them correctly, they will actually prepare themselves to hold their ground in the face of certain trials and dangers that approach when they encounter the unavoidable stage of imagination. This stage is unavoidable because those who seek communication with the higher world, without having passed through it, can do so only unconsciously and are condemned to fumbling in the dark. We can acquire some faint sense of this higher world without imagination. Without it, we can certainly attain a sense of being united with, quote, one's God, close quote, or, quote, one's higher self, close quote. But we cannot come in this way to true knowledge in full consciousness and bright, luminous clarity. Therefore, all talk about coming to terms with the inferior spiritual worlds, parenthesis, the astral and the devaconic, close parenthesis, being unnecessary, or that the only thing necessary is to awaken the God within, in quotes, is no more than illusion. Those who are satisfied with this approach should not be interfered with in their efforts, and an esotericist would not interfere in this way. But true esotericism has nothing to do with such goals. It makes no demand upon anybody to become a student. In those who seek its discipline, however, it will not just awaken a dim perception of themselves as godlike, in quotes, but will try to open their spiritual eyes to the realities of higher worlds. Of course, the, in quotes, divine self is in everyone, in every created being. The divine self is also contained and active in stones, plants, and animals. It is not important to feel and know this in a general way, but rather to establish a living connection with the manifestations of the divine self. Just as we can mutter repeatedly that this world contains the divine self veiled within it, and yet know nothing of the physical world, likewise, those who seek the divine kingdom of spirit only in vague and indeterminate generalities know nothing of higher worlds. We need to open our eyes and see the revelation of deity in the phenomena of the physical world, in a stone or a plant, and not merely dream away all these as mere appearances, with the true form of God somehow concealed, in quotes, behind them. No, God reveals himself in his creations, and those who would know God must first learn to know the true essence of these creations. Therefore, we must also learn to see what really goes on and what lives in the higher worlds if we wish to know the divine. The consciousness that the God-human dwells within us can at best offer a beginning. Experienced in the right way, however, such a beginning leads to an actual lift into the higher worlds. But this is possible only for those in whom the spiritual, in quotes, senses have been developed. Any other view leads only to the thought that one will attain, that one will remain as is and attain only what is possible for to attain in this way. However, the goal of the esotericist is to become a different human being in order to behold and experience things other than the customary ones. It is precisely for this purpose that passage through imaginative knowledge is necessary. It has already been said that this stage of imagination need not be conceived of as a school class that must be gone through. It is to be understood that particularly in present-day life, there are those who bring with them preconditions that enable an esoteric teacher to evoke in them inspired and intuitive knowledge simultaneously, or nearly so, with the imaginative. But it should in no way be understood that any person can be spared passage through the imaginative stage. the cause of danger inherent in imaginative knowledge has already been pointed out in my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds. The cause is that, upon entry to that world, human beings in a certain sense lose the ground beneath their feet. The source of their security in the physical world is for the moment and to all appearances entirely lost. Upon perception of something in the physical world, it is asked, whence comes this perception? This is done mostly unconsciously, but it is quite unconsciously clear that the causes of the perception are objects, in quotes, outside in space. Colors, sounds, and odors radiate from these objects. Colors would not be seen floating free in space, nor sounds heard without consciousness arising as to the objects to which these colors pertain as qualities, and from which these tones arise. Awareness that objects and entities cause physical perceptions gives them, and thus also human beings, security and a sure hold. Those having perceptions without outer causes are seen as abnormal and pathological. Perceptions without causes are called illusions, hallucinations, and visions. Viewed only externally, the imaginative world consists wholly of such hallucinations, visions, and illusions. It has been pointed out in How to Know Higher Worlds that through esoteric training, visions and such are produced artificially. By focusing our consciousness on a seed or a dying plant, certain forms, which are nothing but hallucinations to begin with, are evoked before the soul. Observed outwardly, the, quote, flame formation, close quote, parenthesis, appearing in the soul through observation of a plant or the like, and, after a while, separating itself completely from the plant, close parenthesis, is considered on the same level as an hallucination. It is the same in esoteric training when the imaginative world is entered. What was customarily regarded as going forth from things outside in space or clinging to them as properties, colors, sounds, odors, now float free in space. Perceptions break free from all outer things and swim free in space or fly around in it. Yet it is known with strict accuracy that the things before us have not produced those perceptions, but rather that they are self-induced by the human being. Similarly, one thinks that one has, quote, lost the ground beneath one's feet, close quote. In ordinary life, in the physical world, those inner images that do not proceed from things must be guarded against and are without ground or foundation. But to evoke imaginative knowledge, the prime essential is to have colors, sounds, odors, etc., fully torn loose from all things and floating free in space. The next step toward imaginative knowledge is to find a new, quote, ground and foundation, close quote, for the imaginations that are thus adrift. This must occur in that other world that is now about to be revealed. New things and entities take possession of these inner imaginations. In the physical world, for instance, the color blue stays on a cornflower. In the imaginative world, likewise, it must not remain free-floating. It flows, as it were, towards some being, and whereas it floated unattached at first, it now becomes the expression of a being. Something speaks through it that the observer can perceive only in the imaginative world. And so these free-floating imaginations gather around definite centers. It becomes clear that beings are speaking to us through them. And as in the physical world there are corporeal things and beings to which colors, sounds, odors, and so forth are attached or from which they are derived, so now spiritual beings speak out through them. These spiritual beings are in fact always present. They hover continually around human beings, but cannot reveal themselves to them without an opportunity to do so. They are given this possibility when we manifest the capacity to let sounds, colors, and such arise before our soul, even when not caused by a physical object. Spiritual facts and beings are entirely different from objects and entities of the physical world. In ordinary speech, it is not easy to find an expression that even remotely describes the distinction. Perhaps the best approach is to say that in the imaginative world, everything speaks to us as if it were directly intelligent, whereas in the physical world, intelligence can reveal itself only in a roundabout way, through physicality. This allows flexibility and freedom in the imaginative world. The medium of the outer object is absent, and the spiritual lives itself out with full immediacy in the free-floating tones, colors, and so on. Now, the basis of danger threatening human beings in this world lies in the fact that they perceive the manifestations of spiritual beings, but not the beings themselves. This is the case as long as we remain only in the imaginative world and rise no higher. Only inspiration and intuition lead us gradually to the beings themselves. If, however, the esoteric teacher should awaken these faculties prematurely, without having thoroughly introduced a student to the realm of imagination, the higher world would reveal only a shadowy and phantom-like existence. The whole glorious fullness of the pictures in which it reveals itself, when one really enters into it, would be lost. Herein lies the reason why the esoteric student needs a guide, in quotes. For esoteric students, the imaginative world is at first only a, quote, picture world, close quote, of which, mostly, they do not know the meaning. But the esoteric teacher knows to what things and entities these pictures pertain in a still higher world. If students have confidence in the teacher, they can know that later connections will be revealed, which they cannot yet penetrate. In the physical world, the objects in space were themselves their guides. They were able to prove the accuracy of their inner pictures of them. Physical reality is the rock upon which all hallucinations and illusions must be shattered. This rock disappears into an abyss when the imaginative world is entered. Therefore, the teacher must serve as another such rock. From what the teacher can offer, students must sense the reality of the new world. From this it can be judged what great confidence in the teacher must exist in any esoteric training worthy of the name. When one can no longer believe in the teacher, it is exactly the same in this higher world as if in the physical world everything on which faith in the reality of one's perceptions had been built were suddenly taken away. Apart from this fact, there is yet another that might throw us into confusion if we were to enter the imaginative world without guidance. And as esoteric students, we must first learn to know ourself as distinct from all other spiritual beings. In physical life, we have feelings, desires, longings, passions, ideas, and so forth. Of course, these are all caused by things and beings of the outer world. But we know quite well that they form our inner world, and we distinguish them from the objects of the outer world as events within the soul. But as soon as the imaginative sense is awakened, this ease of differentiation ceases completely. Our feelings, ideas, passions, and so on literally step outside of us and assume form, color, and tone. We stand before them now as we do before wholly strange objects and beings in the physical world. It will be understood that such confusion can become complete when we recall what was said in the chapter titled, quote, Some Results of Initiation, close quote, entitled How to Know Higher Worlds. It describes the way that the imaginative world appears to the observer. All appears reversed, as in a reflection. What flows from us seems as though it were coming toward us from outside. A wish that we cherish changes into a form, say that of some fantastic-looking animal or an entity resembling a human being. It appears to attack us or cause us to do one thing or another. Thus it can happen that we appear to ourselves as surrounded by a wholly fantastic, often charming and seductive or horrible, world of fluttering forms. In reality, these are simply our thoughts, wishes, and passions transformed into images. It would be a great error to believe it easy to distinguish between this self transformed into images on the one hand and the real spiritual world on the other. At first, it is downright impossible for a student to make this distinction. An identical picture can come from some spiritual being that speaks to us or from something in the interior of the soul, and if our development is unduly precipitate at this point, there is danger of never learning to separate the two in an orderly fashion. The greatest caution is the rule in this regard. Now the confusion will be still greater, in that the soul's wishes and desires clothe themselves in images of an opposite character from what they really are. It may be assumed, for instance, that vanity clothes itself in a picture in this way. It may appear as a charming shape, promising wonderful things if its demands are met. Its pronouncements seem to set goals thoroughly good and worthy. When followed, however, they plunge one into moral and other kinds of ruin. Conversely, a good soul quality can clothe itself in unpleasant garb. At this point, only a true knower can differentiate, and only one who is not susceptible to weakening in the correct goal remains steady in face of the seductive artifices of the soul's imagery. From these considerations, one will recognize a need for the guidance of a teacher who, with a sure sense, makes the student attentive to what is fantasy and what is true in this realm. There is no need to believe that a teacher must always stand just behind the student. The presence of the teacher close to the esoteric student in space is not what matters most. Certainly, there is the moment when such spatial presence is desirable, and also when it is absolutely necessary. On the other hand, the esoteric teacher finds means of remaining in touch with the student, even when physically far removed. Moreover, it must be observed that much of what takes place between teacher and student in this sphere, when they meet, can go on working often for months and perhaps for years afterward. But there is one thing that must surely destroy the necessary link between teacher and student. This happens if the student loses confidence in the teacher. It is especially bad when this bond of confidence has been broken before the student has learned to distinguish the illusory reflections of one's soul from reality. Now, it could be argued at this point that if a connection with the teacher occurs in this way, the esoteric student loses all freedom and independence. We give ourselves, so to speak, wholly into the hands of the teacher. This is in truth, however, not at all the case. The various methods of esoteric training certainly differ from one another with respect to dependence upon the teacher. Such dependence can be required to a greater or a lesser degree, and it is greatest in the methods that were followed by Eastern esotericists, who even today teach it as their own. This dependence is less in so-called Christian initiation, and strictly speaking, its complete omission comes on the path of knowledge that, since the 14th century, has come to be advanced by the so-called Rosicrucian esoteric schools. On this path, the teacher can in no way be disregarded. That is impossible. But all dependence on the teacher ceases. How this is possible will be presented in the continuation of these thoughts, when we shall explain precisely how these three paths of knowledge differ the Eastern, the Christian, and the Rosicrucian. In the Rosicrucian approach, there is nothing at all upsetting in any way to a modern person's sense of freedom. It will also be described in this continuation how one person or another as an esoteric student, even in contemporary Europe, may travel not the Rosicrucian, but the Eastern path or the old Christian, although today the Rosicrucian is the most natural. This way, as will be seen in due course, is not at all unchristian. We can go this way without endangering our Christianity, as can also those who suppose themselves to stand at the pinnacle of the modern scientific worldview. But perhaps another explanation is needed. One might feel tempted to ask whether esoteric students could not be spared going through the delusions of their own soul. But if this happened, they would never attain that independent discernment so desirable for them. By no other means can the singular nature of the imaginative world be so well grasped as by the soul's observation. To begin with, we know the inner life of our soul from one side. We are immersed in it, and this is just what the esoteric student has to learn. Not only to look at things from outside, but also to observe them as if we ourselves were within all of them. If our own thought world now meets us as something foreign, and we already know something from one perspective, we can still come to know it from another. We must ourselves become, to a certain degree, the first example of such knowledge. Here in the physical world we are accustomed to something quite different. Here we view all other things only from outside, but we experience ourselves only from the inside. As long as we remain in the physical world, we can never see behind the surface of things. We can never go outside ourselves, quote, slip out of our skin, close quote, as it were, to observe ourselves from outside. This objective observation of ourself is literally our first obligation in esoteric training. This helps us learn to look, as well, beneath the surface of outer facts and beings. The end of essay number 2.